Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's Politics with Amy Walter on The Takeaway. Happy New Year. If we learned anything from the year that was 2020, it was this: expect the unexpected. Now, this doesn't have to mean prepare for disaster or misery, but let's at least acknowledge that we don't know what we're in for in 2021. And that includes our politics. This week, a new Congress comes to Washington. Since the 74th Congress, which began in 1935, every 2 years, on January 3rd, a new Congress convenes. There will be at least 60 new members of the House, and in the weeks since the election, I've been speaking to some of them.
I'm Richie Torres. I'm the congressman-elect for New York 15.
Cliff Bentz. I'm the congressman-elect from Oregon Congressional District 2.
I'm Carolyn Bordeaux, and I am the congresswoman-elect for Georgia's 7th Congressional District.
Marilyn Strickland, 10th District of Washington State.
I'm Ashley Hinson. I'm the congresswoman-elect for Iowa's 1st Congressional District.
My name is Mondaire Jones, congressman-elect. Let me do that again. This is the first time I'm going to be saying this, man. This is kind of cool. Representative-elect from New York's 17th Congressional District.
This freshman class was forged in the midst of unprecedented times. Their campaigns had to learn how to communicate with voters in a time of social distancing, how to address a sudden economic collapse that left so many out of work and struggling just to survive, and discuss racial disparities that brought thousands of Americans to the streets in protest. And while it may take many months to learn what will come to define this Congress, there were two familiar themes that emerged from my conversations. First, what sort of appetite will there be for bipartisanship? And second, how will the two parties come to define themselves? Specifically, a Democratic Party that seems divided between the more centrist leanings of President-elect Joe Biden and the more progressive policies pushed by those like Senator Bernie Sanders and Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Let's start with the bipartisanship. Just before Christmas, Congress passed a bipartisan stimulus bill, but the path to passage was anything but smooth. In the months it took to get the $900 billion package of aid to the president's desk, thousands of small businesses have been shuttered, and millions of Americans have fallen into poverty. President-elect Biden campaigned as a dealmaker who would restore a sense of normalcy back to D.C.
I think I can work with Republican leadership in the House and the Senate. I think we can get things done. And I think once this president is no longer in office, mm-hmm. I think you're going to see his impact on the body politic fade. And a lot of these Republicans are going to feel they have much more room to run and cooperate.
To get a sense of how realistic this could be, I asked just about everyone what issues they think Democrats and Republicans will be able to work together on. Ashley Hinson, a former state representative and local TV anchor, defeated Democratic Congresswoman Abby Finkenauer in Iowa's 1st Congressional District. This sprawling eastern Iowa district has flipped between the two parties three times in just the last 8 years. We spoke a couple weeks after the election, and she pointed to a number of kitchen table issues where she saw the potential for compromise.
Well, I think there's a lot of common ground on what I call the kitchen table issues. We've all been talking about childcare, the cliff effect, some of the challenges surrounding taking leave as a family. I've talked about options for that on the campaign trail. I'm willing to come to the table on that, too, because I realize that's something that our families need. I think there's a middle ground to be had. So if the bill is reasonable, I'm absolutely willing to support the right piece of legislation. That's what I said by running as a common sense conservative here. I'm going to vet every bill. Absolutely. But if it makes sense for the people of the first district, I'll support it. So immigration is another that I think we absolutely need to move forward on. I don't support blanket amnesty, but many Democrats don't either. So I think there are many places in the middle that we can come together and actually move the ball forward, which is what I want to do.
Of course, politics isn't always that clear cut. The pressure to stick with party above all else is intense. Hinson says it's about the context.
Well, and I've always told people where I stand, and there have been people who've supported me with a check who have called me afterward and said, I don't really like the way you voted on this. And I'll say, I'm sorry, I voted for my district. And a lot of times they still support me once I explain the why. So context for me is what really matters in all of this. Being able to explain why I did something, what my perspective on it was, and all the listening that I did beforehand. When I am able to talk about that, I think that does make a difference to people, even when they disagree with you. As far as the partisan aspect, it is tough. And I think that, unfortunately, what we've seen is, you know, with some of the people who've been in Washington, they've been there a very long time. Those relationships are pre-established, and sometimes the personal feelings get in the way, I think, of getting some things done. And so I think, unfortunately, we need a new crop of leaders, and that's what I've stepped up. That's why I stepped up to run for this seat in general, because I want to build that consensus and get things done. I've already told our leadership. I told them when I met with Leader McCarthy last year, I said, there are going to be times when I'm probably going to not vote with the caucus. I'll tell you when I'm not going to, but I'll let you know. And he said, I expect, you know, that's okay. I expect you to have to do that. Just be honest.
I would say that what I learned is that you have to rely, if you're in the minority, a lot on the majority, on what they're going to allow you to do. I mean, it's kind of up to them.
Cliff Bentz represents a more safely Republican district in eastern Oregon, the only Republican district in the state's delegation. Even so, as a state legislator, he spent most of his career in the minority. Joining Congress, where Democrats are in charge, won't be new to him.
And I learned in the last couple of years I was in the Oregon State Senate that the politics of Portland, Oregon had made it extraordinarily difficult for my Democrat friends in the Senate to even allow me as a Republican to be at the table. I was the co-chair of the Carbon Committee, the so-called Carbon Committee, and I was frozen out of the discussions for 5 months on a very, very serious cap and trade bill, one of the more aggressive approaches to managing carbon that I've seen. And I was just not allowed. I wasn't allowed in the room. And that was because my Democrat friends told me later, the folks that put them in office back in Portland didn't want a Republican in the room. And ultimately that meant that we Republican senators walked out to deny the Democrats a quorum and thus prevented the cap and trade bill from passing. But I will share with you, and I've told it to everybody, that that's not the right way to do business. The right way to do business is try to sit down and work these things out. But if you're not at the table, it's pretty tough to do.
During the 2020 presidential primaries, there was a lot of talk about the divide between the more progressive wing of the Democratic Party, led by candidates like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, and the more centrist wing, led by Joe Biden. Biden's success at capturing the nomination, however, hasn't tamped down speculations about the challenges he and Speaker Nancy Pelosi will have at keeping the two sides on the same page in 2021. The fact that Democrats only barely held on to their majority in the House means that either side could derail legislative action.
I tell folks I'm here to take a passionate stand for moderation and common sense and getting the job done for people.
Carolyn Bordeaux was elected in Georgia's 7th congressional district, the only red to blue flip for Democrats in the House this cycle. Now, Democrats did gain two new seats in North Carolina, but those are in districts newly drawn after a court challenge. Bordeaux's suburban Atlanta seat was once a GOP stronghold. Mitt Romney won the district with 60% back in 2012. In November, Joe Biden carried it with 52%.
So if you look at the message we talked about, which came from hundreds of community meetings, my background is in working in the state budget office, and I was a key player in helping bring both parties together to balance the budget during the Great Recession. And that was central, that I had worked with both parties to solve problems in a crisis, and that we needed to bring those same skills and that same engagement to dealing with COVID and to dealing with the healthcare crisis. So I think we are called to just talk to people, to explain that we are listening carefully to what they need and that we are here to be an advocate on their behalf, to fix a lot of the very pressing problems that we are facing in this district as a state and as a country.
Realistically, how does this work given how narrow the margins are and that there doesn't seem to be a lot of incentive for folks to compromise? In other words, the people who are compromising didn't necessarily get reelected, and the people who aren't compromising do win.
We have become very polarized, and it is grounded both in, I think, how we talk to one another, but also in some structural features of our democracy. And one of the things that I strongly favor is nonpartisan redistricting. This is a district that favors that kind of moderation. I would be in little town halls or group settings, and several times I remember people commenting, "Ah, you're so refreshingly moderate." And so that's one of the wonderful things about this district. It is diverse, but it is really people who are grounded in just wanting common sense solutions. They want to end surprise billing. They want their prescription medications to be affordable. They want affordable health insurance. And all of that, you know, is very much a part of my platform. I am concerned about how deeply polarized we have become. And, you know, we'll lean in to trying to bring people together to solve problems. But it may take us a little while to work through this period of really deep division.
You are there to represent everyone and to do your best to pay attention to their needs and to try and do the best you can at the federal level to help the local communities be successful.
And in Washington's 10th congressional district, we actually got a taste for the divide among Democrats. Washington has a top two primary system that pitted two Democrats against each other in the general election. Marilyn Strickland, the more moderate candidate, came out on top. Her Democratic opponent received a lot of support from another Washington congresswoman, Pramila Jayapal, the chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. I asked Strickland what it would be like to serve in the Washington delegation with someone who so vocally and financially supported another candidate in the race.
I mean, I think this is really about focusing on the fact that I am now a member of Congress in this delegation, and a campaign is a campaign, and people do what they think they need to do. So even though the political action committees that she was associated with spent a total of, you know, nearly $1 million, we need to move forward as a country, because if we think about the challenges that we face, they're just profound. And so for me, this isn't necessarily about, you know, a relationship I have with one person in my delegation. This is really about the people that I was elected to represent and how I'm going to be able to represent them.
We also discussed how these divisions might affect Democrats' ability to put an agenda together in D.C.
The rift isn't as large and dramatic as people think it is, although it does exist. But I think the question for us as a party is, you know, we need to move forward together in unity. We need to move forward, focus on the values that we have, because those values are shared with the majority of the American public. You know, my freshman class is relatively small. It's 15 Democrats. But even though we represent different parts of what I call the political ideological spectrum, we all get along well. We are very friendly with each other. And again, we have a set of shared values. And I think that's the way forward for the party, is to think about, we believe in these core values. The distance between one part of the party is not that great. So how do we come together and really clearly communicate what it is we stand for and connect our values with the American people? Because most people agree with what the Democrats stand for, but sometimes it's a conversation about communication. And honestly, how is the press portraying it? How is the media reporting the story? Because you know that contrasts get clicks.
On the Democratic side, one thing I'll be watching closely is the dynamic between the moderate and progressive wings of the party. In 2020, Republican campaigns spent millions of dollars attacking Democratic candidates as beholden to a, quote, socialist agenda and who wanted to defund the police.
Meet radical Bill de Blasio. Think it's Max Rose? Rose supports defunding the police, ending bail, higher middle class taxes.
People like Kara Eastman, who wants to defund the police, will make a tough job tougher than it already is.
Most of the Democrats I've talked to played down this tension. They admit to its existence, but say the media is making a bigger deal than it actually is.
I would argue that the central divide in the Democratic Party is not between moderates and progressives. It's more between what I call purist and pluralist.
Freshman Democrat Richie Torres of New York's 15th Congressional District acknowledges the rift, but has a slightly different way of looking at it.
Right. There are purists who are intent on ideologically purifying the party, challenging incumbents who are thought to be too ideologically impure to effectuate the kind of structural change the country needs. And then there were pluralists who recognize that the Democratic Party has no choice but to be a big tent in order to remain competitive in purple districts and make majorities. I think purists tend to be movement progressives, but not all progressives are purists. There are plenty of progressives in Congress who operate within the system.
There has been a lot of finger pointing over who's to blame for the Democrats' loss of seats in the House in 2020. Just days after the election, in a phone call with the Democratic caucus, Congresswoman Abigail Spanberger placed the blame squarely on progressives.
And we need to not ever use the word socialist or socialism ever again. Because while people think it doesn't matter, it does matter. And we lost good members because of that.
And The Intercept reported that Biden, in a call with civil rights leaders in early December, said that the pressure on the incoming administration around police reform could hurt the party's chances in the Georgia Senate runoffs. Claimed that the Republicans' ability to define the party in favor of defunding the police is how, quote, they beat the living hell out of us across the country.
My expectation is that we will have a data-driven conversation about why we lost House seats this cycle when we should have grown our majority.
Mondaire Jones, another freshman from New York, doesn't think Democrats should give up on big structural change.
One observation that many people, including myself, have made is that all of the candidates in swing districts running on a platform of Medicare for All were reelected in their respective swing districts, Katie Porter, Mr. Golden in Maine, and others. And so it cannot be, as at least one person suggested, that running on big structural changes that meet the moment, especially in a context where a majority of the American people support Medicare for All in the midst of a global pandemic, is somehow fatal to one's electoral prospects. I think that, you know, defunding the police is a separate conversation, and so we need to really look at the data on that. But the most important piece I want everyone to take away with is that no one ran on defunding the police. No one running for Congress ran on defunding the police. I certainly didn't hear anyone say that. I didn't say it. And so it's really important that we have a nuanced conversation when cool heads can prevail. And I'm looking forward to participating in that and to bridging the ideological divides that sometimes make the headlines, but in actuality are not really as divisive as I think the media wants to portray within the caucus.
While Jones highlights the Democratic incumbents who won, even as they supported Medicare for All, he leaves out the fact that at least two other Democratic candidates who were strongly supportive of the policy lost in districts Biden carried, one in Omaha and the other in upstate New York. And freshman Republican Nicole Malliotakis credits her victory to Democratic overreach on the issue of police violence. She defeated first-term Democratic Congressman Max Rose in New York's 11th congressional district, which includes Staten Island and parts of South Brooklyn.
Yeah, this is considered the conservative bastion of New York City in the sense that it is a community which is very family-oriented. Many people are here raising young families. We also have a lot of senior citizens who are more conservative. But what we also have are many civil service workers, mm-hmm. like police officers and firefighters and teachers, and people who are in the middle class and are looking to, you know, get by and are very concerned about increased taxes and rising crime. And the very, very liberal policies that have been put in place under one-party Democratic rule.
When you were campaigning last year, what were the sorts of issues that you think connected most with this, with your constituents?
Well, certainly law and order was a top issue in this campaign. Under Democratic Party rule here in the city and the state, crime has skyrocketed due to a number of criminal justice reforms that have been put in place and have led to career criminals being released back onto our streets. And so people are seeing firsthand how crime has skyrocketed. Everything from shootings to murders to burglaries are up significantly. And they are very much concerned about that. And also a socialist defund the police movement that actually led to $1 billion being cut from the NYPD budget. And this is a community that loves our NYPD, supports law enforcement. They want to see public safety restored to the streets of New York City. And unfortunately, they've seen the decline of our city under Democratic rule. And I think that was part of the message that people were trying to send to individuals like Bill de Blasio, like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and they desperately wanted someone to be their voice to stand up against that. And that is what, you know, I represented and what I'll continue to fight for.
It's swing districts like this where these battles will continue to play out in 2021 and that's right, I'm talking about the next election already, midterms of 2022. But at the end of the day, even with all the rancor and division, part of the reason I continue to have faith in our process is that every one of these candidates ran because they felt that they could make a difference. Here's Mondaire Jones again.
Richie and I will be the first openly gay Black members of Congress. And that is something that, frankly, I never imagined when I was growing up. I did not think that someone like me could run for Congress, let alone get elected. And had I been able to see someone like myself in Congress growing up, it would have been direct evidence of the fact that life really does get better as you grow older and you come into your own. I spent much of my life thinking that there were entire professions closed off to me, including politics, because if I were to run for office, I would have to run as an openly gay candidate, and people would reject that out of hand. And so I'm really excited whenever I get a message, as I often do, from people all throughout my district and all throughout this country, young and old, who are saying that my candidacy is helping them to accept who they are and to live authentic lives. And of course, it is important for me and to so many others, including Richie, I think, to use our lived experiences to inform the policymaking discussions. The experience of queer people of color is an intersectional experience. And to the extent that LGBTQ people have certain challenges, whether it's accessing necessary medical care, or life-saving care, homelessness, especially if you're a young queer person, and so on and so forth, that challenge is compounded when you're a person of color. And I look forward to bringing that perspective into Washington as well.
It's in these moments where you're able to get a sense for the people behind the campaigns. For the last few weeks, Georgia has been the center of the political universe. Joe Biden was the first Democrat in almost 30 years to win the state. For years, southern states like Georgia have sat reliably in the Republican column, but voters in cities like Atlanta and the surrounding suburbs played a definitive role in flipping the state blue. On January 5th, the state will hold runoff elections where Republican Senator Kelly Loeffler will go up against Democratic Reverend Raphael Warnock, and Republican Senator David Perdue will face Democrat John Ossoff. The result of these two races will determine who controls the U.S. Senate at a time where the country has grown increasingly polarized. Joining me to discuss the state's changing electorate and what that means for the future of statewide races is Andra Gillespie, an associate professor of political science at Emory University.
You know, what's changed in the state was that in the 2000s, we see a growth in the African-American electorate, so that by the time we're getting to the 2008 and the 2012 elections, Blacks make up about 30% of registered voters in the state. And then since 2012, we have seen the Asian American and Hispanic electorate grow. So it's doubled since 2012. And so while it's still a small part of Georgia's electorate, it's growing fast enough that along with African American voters and liberal Democratic voters who are white, Democrats are in a position to be competitive. Now, the numbers alone aren't what, you know, has made Georgia vote Democratic in this particular election. There's been a lot of political organizing behind the scenes to tap into latent Democratic voters, to get them registered to vote, to get them educated about the process, to get them mobilized, that really paid off in this particular election. So, you know, it's in part the multiracial coalition, which I think distinguishes Georgia from other parts of the Deep South, but it's also just this idea of mobilization and organization. And the Democratic Party of 10 years ago in Georgia wasn't equipped to do that. But the new Democratic Party, largely led by the efforts of Stacey Abrams, is in a much better position to be competitive. I don't think that Democrats are, you know, now going to win every election going forward. I think we're headed into a period of contestation where we're going to have close election outcomes where Democrats win and sometimes lose elections. But Georgia, you know, is decidedly now a swing state.
Let's talk about that. Dig into you. The point you made about Stacey Abrams and her success not just in 2018 in really engaging African-American voters and voters of color, but the work that's been done on the ground now for years in finding, registering, and now turning out voters of color. What happens now in an era post-Trump, in an era where, you're right, we kind of maybe go back to quote-unquote normal elections?
Some people are going to wonder whether or not this moment where Donald Trump has been on the ballot are a bit of an outlier. So if races have become more competitive in the Trump era because of how divisive Donald Trump is. And, you know, I have two answers to that question. I mean, one, we are going to pay attention to what subsequent election outcomes look like to see what post-Trump voting behavior looks like. But I also think it's really important to point out that these efforts at party building that Stacey Abrams and other groups that were, you know, mostly just interested in making sure that people of color turned out to vote. So the Georgia Coalition for the People's Agenda, Black Voters Matter, et cetera, right? These folks have been on the ground and they were working long before Donald Trump descended that escalator in 2015. And so, and the projections and the aspirations that the Democratic Party of Georgia had predate the emergence of Donald Trump as a national political figure. So, you know, and the narrowing of elections started before Donald Trump really emerged on the scene in a fulsome way. So if we look at the numbers, we see increased voter turnout, you know, amongst both Democrats and Republicans. It's how Joe Biden and Donald Trump, you know, have earned the highest and second highest number of votes ever in a presidential election in U.S. history. And so, you know, the Trump campaign does deserve credit for its own mobilization efforts. I interpret their increased voter turnout two different ways. So just in terms of just the vote choice standpoint, it looks like both the Democrats and the Republicans drilled down deeper into their base to drive up turnout amongst people who they knew were predisposed to vote for them. So I think the story still holds about how Donald Trump didn't really expand his base. But I think the important thing to kind of take away from what Trump did was that Trump did focus on voter mobilization. And, you know, I'm less interested in what was happening sort of on stage at the rallies, because those don't vote. But it was the data that they were collecting on people who attended rallies. It was the voter registration that was happening at rallies that allowed for opportunities for the campaign to collect data and follow up on voters that are standard operating procedure for if you're going to do a good mobilization campaign. And so the Trump campaign deserves credit for its GOTV efforts.
There's these runoff elections and two Senate races, of course. And one race features African-American candidate, the Democrat, Raphael Warnock. And I'm wondering what you think the impact will be of having an African-American candidate on the top of the ticket, and if that may be enough to keep voters who might drop off, say Democratic voters who showed up in the election, to stay engaged, and what your expectations are for what turnout could look like.
The last time there was a Senate runoff in Georgia was in 2008. Again, third-party candidate played a little bit of a spoiler for the Republican incumbent, Saxby Chambliss, and the Democratic candidate, Jim Martin, overperformed expectations in part because Barack Obama was on the ballot that year. When it moves to the runoff, the race did go back to an equilibrium, something that would have been perceived more normal for that time period, where Chambliss was able to win pretty handily in the runoff election. And, you know, at that time, that was very much a reflection of the fact that there were more Republicans than there were Democrats in Georgia. I think what the general election results prove is that the Democrats have grown their base, and there are more Democratic voters in the state than there have been in a long time, proportionally speaking. And so the campaigns, both campaigns have to assume a rough parity in terms of the numbers of voters that each party has at their disposal. And ultimately, I think this is going to come down to voter turnout. So whichever party has the best turnout operation is going to be the party that wins.
Andra Gillespie, as usual, you bring so much knowledge and insight to these discussions. Thank you so much for spending the time with me. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you.
Andrew Gillespie is an associate professor of political science at Emory University. It's Politics with Amy Walter on The Takeaway. In just a few days, Georgia will hold two runoff elections that will determine which party controls the U.S. Senate. Democrats need to win both seats to take the majority. Gradual demographic change, especially in metro areas, have pushed this one-time Republican stronghold into swing state territory. At the same time, grassroots organizations, many of them led by Black women, have spent years organizing and registering voters, especially Black voters. Among them, Deborah Scott, the executive director of Georgia Stand Up, an organization working to register and turn out voters and voters of color.
Because Georgia Stand Up has been around for the last 16 years, we have a strong base of community allies and support throughout the state, but we're primarily in the metro area, which is 13 to 30 counties. That's where 60% of the population in Georgia really live.
So far, we've seen high turnout when it comes to early voting and absentee ballots. I talked to Deborah Scott about what Stand Up Georgia is working on ahead of the runoff elections.
In this election, which is, of course, we know one of the most important elections of our lifetime, we can say we know as a group of nonprofits, organizations that are working together, we have built this base over time, 10, 15 years of constantly doing voter registration and voter education and advocacy, that the state would eventually become progressive. So we had the metro area that was progressive, but the rest of the state was falling behind. And so we saw that we could be of service to the community by enhancing our voter registration capacity, enhancing the capacity to do canvassing in the community. We did 1.9 million calls last cycle. So we have a phone bank and a text bank, and we have canvassers, and we're doing special events. What we're trying to do in this particular election is pretend that November never happened, and this is the first election of the year.
Well, that's my question to you. Maybe it's a two-part. One, how much of this is still registering folks who maybe even after all the work that you all have done, did not register in time for the 2020 November election? And how much of this is making sure people who did turn out and who voted and who registered in time for the November election come out again right after New Year's to vote in a special election, two special elections?
Well, first of all, there are 23,000 young people that were not old enough to vote in November that are now eligible for this upcoming election. And so one of the things that we're doing is reaching out to the school systems to give them a civics education as part of their curriculum this week, because we want them to get them registered to vote. So we've sent them QR codes and Bitly codes so that they can send it directly to their students that are studying at home so that they can get registered to vote. So if they're 17 and a half in Georgia and they're going to be 18 by the time of the election, they can actually vote. So the deadline for voter registration is actually Monday, December 7th. So right now we're in that last push to get folks that need to get registered to vote. Maybe they didn't know about it, or maybe they didn't get their information in on time. But then also people that are frequent voters, we often have people in our family that you just assume were registered to vote. And so we're going back to our voters and saying, okay, Mrs. Jackson, thank you so much for voting. Look what you did. This is a historic election. So can you give me a list of the five people in your family that aren't registered to vote? We don't even ask her, are there five people, right? We're asking her, we know there are five people in your family that need to vote. And they, oh yeah, my cousin needs to. And so we get them engaged in this process, and we challenge her to go back to her family and say, this is important and we need to register to vote. We focus a lot on Black women because that's the base of our operation here, because many of the community campaigns we work on are quite frankly led by women. So Black and Brown women are really doing their thing here in Georgia. And, you know, forget about this last November election, that is done. This is a new election, and you have an opportunity not just to make history, because that doesn't appeal to somebody when you're talking to them at their door. you want to talk to them about their pain points. What's going on in their neighborhood? Is the street light working? Is there a pothole in the middle of your street? Are your neighborhoods organizing? Did you know this development project is coming? We're talking to them about what is their family's point of pain and how the electoral process can actually help to solve that. And we kind of move into, well, okay, so the unemployment rate is high. And then that might lead into a conversation. Yeah, I have two people in my family that are not working. Okay, were you able to get unemployment? Oh, the line was so long and we didn't get it. So what we try to do is to get them connected to some of the issues and the problems that they have are really policy issues.
One more quick thing. I know you all are a nonpartisan organization. You're just encouraging people to go and vote. And yet, we also know that the president and many Republicans in the state are suggesting that this election in Georgia was fraudulent, that the Secretary of State and the voting machines were rigged. Is that impacting, do you think, people's trust in this process and their desire to actually go out and cast a ballot?
So in our communities that we work with are mostly Black and Brown. They are used, in particularly in Georgia, they are used to voter suppression tactics. And so part of what we try to teach them is, don't worry about the noise of the politics of all of this. You still have a responsibility. I think that they are voter fatigue based on the ads that they see. They're so negative. And the news that is happening every day that people are like, I don't want to hear it anymore. But when you have that one-on-one conversation with them, whether you're having it at the phone or on the door, when you make it personal and you talk about the historic factor in this, and not only did they make it hard, not just this year, but 40 years ago and 20 years ago, this is just a part of a continuum, but we still have an obligation and a responsibility to say that in spite of these obstacles, you still have to do it.
Deborah Scott is executive director of Georgia Stand Up. We started the show by introducing you to some of the new members of Congress. They'll be coming to D.C. at a time not just of historic polarization, but also a serious health pandemic. President-elect Joe Biden and many of the newly elected members I spoke with over these last few weeks are optimistic about the prospects for a more functional legislative process in 2021. A narrowly divided House and Senate makes the possibility of bipartisanship or gridlock equally possible. Any group of 5 to 10 members could easily derail or commandeer the spotlight. To understand what governing could look like in the new year, I reached out to someone who has spent a lot of time on Capitol Hill in 2020. Nick Fandos, a congressional correspondent for the New York Times.
No matter what happens in the Georgia runoffs in a few days that we're waiting on, Congress is going to be very narrowly divided. Nancy Pelosi in the House is going to have probably the narrowest majority in over 100 years. The Senate, at best, is going to be divided 50-50 with Democrats in control, at best for them. It may be a narrow Republican majority. I think what this stimulus deal that came together in the last few weeks has shown is that there are a set of kind of centrists in both parties that are chomping at the bit to get things done and feel like finally their day has come to do that, and leadership, at least for now, seems willing to entertain it. And I think, crucially, you have a president-elect in Joe Biden, who's somebody that would have identified with that centrist group of lawmakers in crafting deals. So it's kind of a lot of factors, I think, that are coming together that suggest, certainly not on every issue, but on matters of spending, maybe infrastructure, maybe some healthcare policy, not the big stuff, but around the edges, that this could be kind of a durable coalition that can put enough votes together and enough pressure on their leaders to get stuff done.
Look at you, glass half full kind of person here. Okay, I'll bring
in.
I
don't sound like a reporter there, but
I know. All right, so I'll bring in the downer. Then I'll bring in the half empty, which is okay. I see what you're saying, but at the same time, we know that we are headed into, as we always are, an election year, and 2022 is going to be a hard-fought battle for control of Congress. As you pointed out, House and Senate both very narrowly divided. Control of both are on the line. Do you think that at some point, pretty quickly on, the politics of trying to win a political fight in 2022 are going to overcome this moment of bipartisanship in getting stuff done in Congress?
I suppose that I think there is some mutual political interest for Democrats and Republicans in trying to accomplish a few things ahead of 2022, when several incumbent Republicans are going to be running in purple or bluish states, mm-hmm. and are going to want to show some accomplishments, when House Republicans are going to want to show that they're a governing party. So again, I think infrastructure is a real possibility. The President-elect Biden has made clear that that's a top priority for him. He views that as a way not just to address the backlog of need to invest in roads and bridges and internet and things like that, but as a way to try and stimulate the economy too, as we continue to, you know, buckle under the coronavirus crisis. I think that's one potential issue. You know, prescription drug pricing could be another, right. because there's a lot of political upside for both parties. You know, but I agree. I think you can see a scenario where pretty quickly a lot of political energy goes into confirming a Biden cabinet. There's a lot of fights around that. Mm. And the goodwill quickly fades. And I think as hopefully vaccines are distributed and the country begins to come out of this coronavirus crisis, we may see a little less will to be spending big chunks of money and be working across the aisle on kind of innovative solutions to get the country through it.
Can you talk a little bit about, at first, the Democratic caucus and the role that members like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and those on the left you think will play in giving either Pelosi the vote she needs or preventing Pelosi from doing certain things?
The reality of having very narrow majorities, as you say, is, you know, if AOC and the squad or other progressives lock arms, even if it's just five or six of them, that could be enough votes to, you know, tank or completely alter a bill. And the same thing is true among the moderates, the New Democrats or the Blue Dogs, as they're known on that wing of the party. So I think the result is that what we're going to see from Democrats, contrary to, you know, what I think almost anybody in the party would have hoped going into the election, is they're going to have to focus on either bipartisan issues, if they want to get them to law, or heavily kind of consensus issue for Democrats. And there are, you know, a good number of those: greater gun controls, some updates to Obamacare, to prescription drug pricing, the Equality Act, things like that, which I think can still get through. But so much of this dynamic is going to, I hate to keep going back to it, depend on what happens in a few days in Georgia. Right, in I think Georgia. If Democrats do win the Senate, I think progressives are going to be a lot louder and more aggressive about using the majorities they have right now to do big things Democrats want to do. If Republicans keep the House, I think they're going to have to be realistic that they're not going to get much done and focus their energy on where they have in the last couple of years, which is in the kind of the political realm of trying to push the party further to the left.
It's somewhat interesting because even though Pelosi has a smaller majority than she did, say, after the 2008 election, she doesn't have as many sort of conservative Democrats to have to worry about, right? So an issue like guns or climate, which were much more problematic for her more conservative members in parts of the country that are now in Republican hands, now the party seems more unified, at least.
I think there are significant differences in terms of style and aggressiveness that are going to come to the fore. And, you know, Republicans have their own questions that they're going to be facing on this front, too. I mean, obviously, a lot will depend on how prominent a figure President Trump remains within the party and on the national stage, probably a pretty prominent one, and how those other, you know, perhaps slightly younger Republicans' aspirations lead them to behave around him. You know, whether they decide to take a more conciliatory approach or that the president's kind of pugilistic hardline tactics are the way to go could also determine what happens in Congress these 2 years.
Nick Fandos, Thank you so much for coming on and helping us walk through this. We'll be talking a lot more about it, obviously, in the weeks and months to come.
Thank you, Amy, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Nick Fandos, a congressional correspondent for the New York Times. That's all for us today. Our senior producer is Amber Hall. Patricia Jacob is our associate producer. Polly Irungu is our digital editor. David Gable is our executive assistant. Jay Cowett is our director and sound designer. Debbie Daughtry is our board op. Vince Fairchild is our board op and engineer. Our executive producer is Lee Hill. Call us anytime at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet. I'm at Amy E. Walter. The show is at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. It's Politics with Amy Walter on The Takeaway. Happy New Year, everyone.